Welcome to the Thomistic Institute podcast. Our mission is to promote the Catholic intellectual tradition in the university, the church, and the wider public square. The lectures on this podcast are organized by university students at Thomistic Institute chapters around the world. To learn more and to attend these events, visit us at thomisticinstitute.org.
As Maria mentioned, I'm going to talk about identity versus nature. So we're going to be looking at what Thomas Aquinas has to say about nature and putting that in conversation with some contemporary identity theory. Nowadays, I'm going to go out on a limb and guess more people are familiar with identity theory than Aquinas' account of nature, so we're going to spend a little more time there. This is the Thomistic Institute, after all. And then we'll turn to identity theory at the end, so let's begin. In order to understand what it means to be human, we first have to ask what it means to be anything at all, why there's such a diversity of creatures on Earth, and what it means to be one creature rather than another. In the physics, Aristotle describes four ways in which we can talk about what makes a thing to be what it is. We can talk about what it's made of, we can talk about the shape into which it's made, we can talk about who or what made it into that shape, and we can talk about what its purpose is. So to take one classic example, you could imagine a bronze statue of a horse. First, we can talk about what it's made of. Aristotle describes this as its material cause, and in this example, the answer is bronze. Not bronze already fashioned into the shape of a horse, but bronze without any shape or form at all. It's impossible to imagine this perfectly, because in this world, matter never exists without form. Anytime you try to imagine bronze, you're going to imagine it in some kind of shape or other, but for the sake of illustration, picture a lump of bronze sitting there in the sculptor's shop on the shelf. That lump makes a statue to be bronze. Next, we can talk about the shape. Aristotle describes this as the statue's formal cause. Technically, you can't imagine the shape of a horse outside of matter any more than you can imagine matter without some shape. But if you try to picture in your mind the most generic horse possible, perhaps a stick figure, which if I was going to embarrass myself, I would attempt to draw on this board here, the shape makes the statue to be the horse. So we've got bronze on the one hand and horse on the other, and we're trying to imagine them separately, but we can't do so perfectly. We need to put them together in some way. And in the real world, that's the job of a sculptor. The sculptor is the one who does the work of making a casting, melting down the bronze, pouring it into the casting, cooling it, and thus combining the matter and the form into a bronze horse. And Aristotle describes the sculptor as the statue's efficient cause, the agent who combines its matter and form, so you get a sculpture. But why is the sculptor busy in his workshop making a bronze horse in the first place when he could be at home drinking a beer and watching the football game? What is the statue of a bronze horse for? That's a more complicated question, but it also tells us something about what the bronze horse is. Is it a paperweight? A decoration for someone's shelf? The top of a trophy? The centerpiece of a monument in the center of a city? There's got to be some reason that motivates the sculptor to get up off the couch, turn off the television, stop watching the football game, and make the bronze horse. Could be for fun, for beauty, for money, to impress someone, to practice his craft, a civic duty that he's been assigned, or maybe he's just obsessed with horses. The possibilities are nearly endless, but not completely endless, and that's because the matter in the form of a bronze horse impose certain limits on what the horse can be for. A bronze horse is not very useful for sweeping the floor of your workshop or painting its ceiling. And it can't really help you rake up the leaves outside, and if you snuggle it, it's not going to keep you very warm on a cold winter's night. Bronze doesn't do these things, neither do horses. All the more so does a bronze horse not do them either. In these situations, you need other materials with other shapes made by other craftsmen, because each combination of matter and form, each material thing, has limits. Can there be things that are good for sweeping the floor, painting your ceiling, raking your leaves, keeping you warm at night? Absolutely. But to sweep, you need a broom made of wicker, to paint a brush made of bristles, to gather leaves a rake made of metal, plastic, whatever, to keep you warm at night a blanket made of cotton, wool, or down. Wicker doesn't make a good statue, and bronze doesn't make a good broom. Horses don't sweep floors, and brooms don't make particularly good monuments. In the whole of creation, there are materials that are useful for some things and materials that are useful for other things. And the challenge of a good craftsman is to find the right material, to fashion it into the right shape for the right job. When that happens, you can use a real thing in real life to fulfill the purpose for which it was made. And when that doesn't happen, you can't. Given that there are four causes that go into making a thing to be what it is, Aristotle asks in the Physics, which of them is most important, which plays the biggest role in causing a thing to be what it is? And he centers in, he homes in on form. That's because form gives to matter two things that matter can't give to itself. First, it makes it to be something. Matter, raw material, can be fashioned into nearly anything. Our lump of bronze could become a horse or a dog or George Washington or Abraham Lincoln. When it's still a lump, it has the potential to be any of these things. But as a lump, it's pretty useless. Only when we limit the range of the things it could possibly become, by fulfilling its potential to actually become one of those things, does the lump of bronze become useful in some way. If we fashion it into a horse, we can have a paperweight, an ornament, a monument, but we can't have a bust of George Washington. The reverse is also true. In either case, we fulfill the potential for the bronze to be something, but only at the cost of limiting its potential to be any of the other things it could have ever been. In this way, form gives to matter a nature, a more limited set of potential to be this and not that, to do this and not that. The second thing that form does to matter is that it makes it to be at all. This one's hard to conceptualize and takes a bit of imagining, but it's equally important. If a lump of bronze has lots of potential, but isn't very useful until you actualize its potential to be one thing rather than another, what would pure matter, prime matter in the language of Aquinas, be like? Something that was in pure potential to be anything at all, but didn't even have the shape of a lump. Aquinas's answer is that it wouldn't be at all. Pure potentiality doesn't exist. Because the moment something comes into existence, it exists as something and not as something else. A lump of bronze is still bronze, and it's still a lump. If you had pure matter, it would be pure potency to become anything in any shape. So Aristotle, and Aquinas with him, says that form not only gives nature to matter, but also existence to matter. It simultaneously makes a thing to be, and also limits its potential to a certain set of abilities in orientation towards a specific purpose. But where do nature and being, essence, and existence come from? That's a more complicated question, but it's at the very center of the relationship between nature and identity. Aquinas answers this question in the midst of his famous five proofs for the existence of God. For our purposes today, we'll focus on the second way. Looking at the natural world around us, Aquinas begins with the simple observation that nothing is the cause of itself. In one sense, that's just a logical truism. If a thing caused itself, Aquinas observes, then it would have to pre-exist itself, which is impossible, because that would violate the law of non-contradiction. A thing cannot be and not be at the same time and in the same respect. But it's also something that can be readily observed in the world around us. A plant doesn't cause itself, it comes from a seed. A seed doesn't cause itself, it comes from another plant. Baby animals don't cause themselves, they come from their parents. And their parents don't cause themselves, they come from their parents. So when we look at the world around us, we don't see things that cause themselves, we see a series of things in which one thing causes another, and that thing causes the next, and so on and so forth. So where did the various series of causes come from? Is it turtles all the way down, as the ancient myth would have it? That's a trickier question, and Aquinas tackles it from a few different angles. First, he homes in on the fact that every series of causes has an order to it, with some definite purpose, which is to say it has a final cause. The food chain is a perfect example of this. If we're looking at an oak tree, the key to the series of causes is the production of acorns. The production of acorns serves a twofold purpose. It helps perpetuate the existence of oak trees, and it feeds animals like squirrels, chipmunks, and birds. If we're looking at the squirrels, the key to the series of causes is the generation of baby squirrels. These two serve a twofold purpose: the perpetuation of the existence of squirrels and the feeding of animals yet higher on the food chain, coyotes, foxes, bobcats. And even at the top of the food chain, an animal like a bobcat follows the same pattern. The generation of bob kittens perpetuates the existence of bobcats, and they in turn take over from their parents in regulating the health of the food chain below them. So where did all these ordered series come from? Each with their purpose, and all with their purposes interlinked and coordinated with one another. Aquinas argues that there must be some first cause that explains the existence of the other causes in the series, together with the fact that they are all interlinked together. We can see examples of this all around us. Think of a building. Without an architect, all you have is a pile of building materials instead of a building. Or imagine an orchestra. Without a composer, all you have is a bunch of meaningless noise instead of a symphony. To get things into an ordered series, you need an intelligent agent to order them. Otherwise, all you have is random chaos. And it's no different in the natural universe. Without a first cause, all you have is a bunch of meaningless chaos instead of species and an ecosystem. In the natural universe, we can take Aquinas' argument a step further than we can with the examples of building or a symphony. Architects work with pre-existing building materials and conductors with mature musicians. But in the natural universe, we're not only talking about how things fit together, we're also talking about how the pieces got there at all. After all, part of the ordered series in the natural universe is the production of the things in it, plants coming from seeds, animals coming from their parents, and so on and so forth. This means that for the ordered series that is the natural universe to exist, there must be some first cause that explains not only how the pieces fit together, but why each piece exists in the first place, and also why it exists with the particular properties and purpose that it has, that is to say, why it has the nature that it has. Aquinas says that this first cause is what all people call God, an intelligent being outside the universe that confers being and nature upon the things in the universe and orders them together with one another into various series of causes. Without God, we don't just have chaos, we actually have nothing, because we have no beings. Conversely, the minute we have beings, we have both natures and order, because the moment God makes beings, he confers nature and order upon them. Okay, so far, our discussion of nature has been relatively generic. What does all this look like in the case of human beings? We're here to talk about ourselves, after all. Human beings are somewhat of an anomaly among all living creatures. Every other living creature is confined to a life lived at the level of material bodily existence and can be studied at that level. But human beings straddle the immaterial and the material, the universal and the particular, the spiritual and the bodily realms of existence. And that makes human life more interesting than animal life, because it's ordered above the level of the material world to the world of knowledge and love. In Aquinas' account of the universe, knowledge and love may be above material creation, but they are by no means outside of it. In unpacking the Christian doctrine of creation, Aquinas explains that God freely chose to create precisely in order that he might share his spiritual perfections with creatures, as much as each creature could possibly receive. Now, no one creature can possibly contain a perfect and complete reflection of all the perfection of God. Each creature, in its nature, reveals some tiny and in an imperfect way the glory of the one who made it. At the pinnacle of creation are human beings who are made in the image and likeness of God, precisely insofar as we are uniquely able to share not only in the life of other animals, but also in the knowledge and love of God who made us. In terms of the human body, no one disputes that there are things that are good for us and things that are bad for us. That's because it's an observable fact that the things that are good for us, a well-balanced diet, regular exercise, and all those other things we should be doing, make us regularly and observably healthy, while things that aren't good for us make us regularly and observably sick. What doctor in their right mind would counsel you to go on a diet of brownies, cigarettes, and Coca-Cola? The doctors don't do that because they know it's bad for you. You hopefully don't do it either because you know that it's bad for you too. We can't change the nature of our bodies, but we can study it and learn how to take good care of it. But the body's only one part of human nature. Since human beings have both a body and a soul, we need to devote equal study, care, and attention to the study of the soul, to the things that are good for it, to the things that are bad for it. In classical philosophy, these are the virtues and the vices, respectively. Virtues are habits that perfect some aspect of our nature by working with it, and vices are habits that corrupt some aspect of our nature by working against it. A good example is the virtue of temperance. The temperate person interacts reasonably with things that cause pleasure or pain. The intemperate person doesn't. The temperate person recognizes that one brownie is an appropriate dessert, but not 10, and so limits himself or herself to an appropriately sized dessert at the end of dinner. The intemperate person may know that he or she should limit himself or herself to one brownie, but the desire for more overwhelms their reason and they fill their plate to overflowing. With enough intemperance, the intemperate person may even lose touch with the idea of temperance entirely. But that's not going to stop the natural consequences to that person's body from setting in, pound after pound after pound. And it's no different with the soul. The psychologists tell us that things like food addiction are not purely the result of giving in to a hunger craving. With any addiction, there's also a psychological component. We not only look for the pleasure of eating a sweet, tasty thing, but more so for the fleeting comfort that that pleasure brings us. It sets us up for a vicious cycle. We give ourselves over to something, we feel fulfilled for a moment, then it lets us down, so we give ourselves over to it again. And it's the same with other addictions, whether physical or spiritual, drugs, alcohol, sex, pornography, the pursuit of money, fame, power, you name it. What all these pursuits have in common is that they aren't good for us. And the sign that they aren't good for us is that as we freely choose to give ourselves over to them yet more completely, we slowly lose our freedom to them. They say the sign of an addiction is when you can't stop even when you want to. That is to say, when it takes away your freedom. And slowly it begins to take over your life, as your pursuit of it becomes more all-encompassing. With enough of an addiction, the addict may lose touch with normal life entirely. But again, that won't stop the natural consequences to his or her soul from setting in time after time after time. So how do we go about living a truly free life? That depends on what we mean by freedom. The Thomistic moral theologian Servet Pinker says that there are two basic ways to talk about freedom. One is freedom from constraint. In a sense, we exercise that kind of freedom anytime we make any choice at all, good or bad. The very definition of a free choice is that no one forced us to make it. But as we've seen, some choices we can make, if they are contrary to our nature, actually end up imposing constraints on our freedom as time goes by. That is to say, that if we make bad choices, if we make choices that are contrary to our nature, we can use our freedom to lose our freedom. So Pinker's offers us a second kind of freedom, freedom for excellence. Freedom for excellence is a freedom from the constraints that we impose on ourselves by choices that are contrary to our nature. The only way to attain that kind of freedom is to act in accord with our nature regularly and consistently. That is to say, to act virtuously. For the better part of the last century, the idea that we should act regularly and consistently in accord with our nature has become increasingly, and I say this with full force, increasingly terrifying. Not an exaggeration. In his famous book, Being in Time, the German philosopher Martin Heidegger gave shape to what this terror looks like and feels like. Heidegger thought that our default mode as human beings is to be part of the crowd. That is, part of a sea of people leading a so-called normal life. Going through school, here we are, getting married, having a family, holding down a job, retiring, helping to raise grandchildren, and then you know what comes next. Heidegger described leading a normal life like this as a kind of falling, that is, falling towards failure. The failure of wasting our personal potential to be more than just a nameless face in a sea of existence. To truly succeed in life, Heidegger proposed that we need to wake up and decide to become an individual, that we need to take responsibility for our individuality by choosing to make something of ourselves. By definition here, making something of ourselves means standing out, doing something outside the normal course of life, the boring course of life that everyone else is living. For Heidegger, this is how you give yourself what later scholars will refer to as a personal identity. In a sense, you not only determine who you are, but what you are as well. And this theory of the purpose of human life is commonly called expressive individualism. It is literally the foundation for the plotline of every Disney movie ever made. Okay, while it's virtuous to realize your potential for excellence through personal choices that develop your natural gifts, the problem with Heidegger's thought is that it sets up an opposition between authenticity and identity on the one hand and nature on the other. That's because large amounts of normal everyday existence are in fact just part of what it means to live according to nature. Going to school, having a family, holding down a job are normal because nature itself inclines us to do these things as part of certain what Aquinas calls natural inclinations, to self-preservation, having and raising children, knowing the truth, living in society. In other words, they're normal because they're good for us. And they're good for us, we know, because nature inclines us to them. So if in the quest to lead a better than normal life, to avoid the failure of wasted potential, we tell ourselves that we have to step out from normal life to be uniquely individual, the danger is that we'll quickly start to think, whether implicitly or later explicitly, that to be authentic, to be real, to be in some sense ourselves, we have to act contrary to nature. The moment that happens, we're in danger. We've got the angel and the devil whispering different things on our shoulders. From one side, we hear that we should live according to nature to be happy and free. From the other side, we hear that we have to live in some respects contrary to nature to be happy and free. If we listen to the darker of these two voices, then our quest for authenticity and individuality might well lead down the same road that misused freedom always does, to the point that you lose your freedom rather than gaining it and need to be rescued to have it restored once more. Over the course of the 20th century, the antipathy between nature and identity gradually increased. One of the most important milestones in the increase of that opposition is in the work of Judith Butler, a contemporary philosopher of gender studies. Gender studies is a field where there's always been a fair bit of tension between nature and identity. That's because although a division according to male and female is natural to the human species, and so as a biological reality imposes certain conditions in terms of what can contribute to or detract from our human flourishing, like the existence of parents, grandparents, cousins, aunts, uncles, and the like, okay? There's always been a large amount of cultural diversity in terms of how life surrounding the biological realities of male and female are lived out. There are some realities that don't change even in the most advanced reproductive technologies. But beyond those most basic realities, families can look a little bit different in different cultures. What family looks like in America might look a little different in England, or might look a little different in Germany, or outside of Europe in another continent. Each human culture has to adapt and apply the realities and needs of human nature to its particular setting. Previous thinkers in anthropology and gender studies tried to account for the need to apply and adapt nature's realities to particular settings by distinguishing between terms which they divided as sex, which they would say describes a person's natural biological characteristics, and gender, which they would say would describe a person's cultural role. But truth be told, there was always a bit of tension between these two categories. Does sex determine gender? Or to put it more specifically, are there certain roles that are natural to men and women and which therefore transcend cultures? If so, how far do those roles extend beyond the natural, biological, or we might even just say medical facts associated with human reproduction? Butler sought to eliminate this tension. If previous generations had erred on the side of reducing gender to sex, Butler went in the other direction by reducing sex to gender. In her book, Gender Trouble, Feminism, and the Subversion of Identity, your gender is what you choose to do rather than a component of what you are. It is one aspect of the identity you select in the pursuit of authenticity. It has no anchor whatsoever in a sort of natural reality, including the biological realities of human reproduction. In a sense, Butler took Heidegger's work to its logical conclusion. If the key to authentic life is to stick out beyond the crowd, then aren't the groups male and female two very large crowds from which one would want to stick out? Butler didn't stop at trying to open up the possibility of stepping out between male and female. She also tried to create a sense of a moral imperative to do so. She did that by suggesting that the normal social systems that assign binary genders are not just bland and unfulfilling, as Heidegger's work might be extended to imply, but are in fact oppressive because they are inextricably bound up with systems of domination. She did this by adding something to Heidegger from the work of the continental philosopher Michel Foucault. Foucault thought that if we want to understand how power is exercised in society, we need to look not just at labels and titles, but at what actually happens, who people actually listen to, how people actually treat and in many instances use one another, how people actually lead, and who people actually follow. He was particularly attentive to how these dynamics play out in the relationship between the genders. Butler added to Foucault's understanding of how power is pervasively and abusively wielded, Butler added Foucault's understanding of how power is pervasively and abusively wielded to Heidegger's understanding of normal life to suggest that leading a normal life, in this case, one that is simply male or female, is not just something undesirable to be transcended if we want to be fulfilled, but something oppressive and toxic which we need to be liberated from if we want to survive. Because in this case, the labels male and female, these two large crowds from which we are allegedly supposed to want to stick out, are impositions on our freedom from outside, but those kinds of impositions don't come for no reason. They come particularly by means of an assertion of power over ourselves. So what do we do? Butler suggests that we should create for ourselves our own gender identity. This identity establishes not only who, but in a certain sense, what we are. And since Butler's understanding of gender identity is not tied to a binary biological reality, the possibilities for potential gender identities are nearly endless, all the more so if we consider that Butler's understanding of gender identity not only seeks to transcend the categories of man and woman, but also any sense of a normative biological complementarity between them. Aquinas and Butler present us with contrasting views of who or what creates me, and applying a Thomistic analysis to Butler's thought leaves us with several important questions to consider. The first regards existence itself. According to Butler, one may choose any identity one wishes, but to choose an identity, a person must first exist. And while Butler's argument advises a person what to do once that person exists, the choice of an identity cannot change the fact that each existing person choosing an identity exists as part of an ordered series of causes, with their parents bringing them into existence, and their parents bringing them into existence, and so on and so forth. Aquinas' argument in favor of the existence of nature proceeds first and foremost on that logically prior level. Without a first cause, the ordered series of causes of which individual human beings are a part simply wouldn't exist, and therefore we ourselves would not exist, and all the more so would we not be sitting around choosing gender identities. Yet as the first cause, God not only creates the series, but also the nature that gives that series its order. And the ordering in the series is a result of the nature. The second regards the goal of existence. For Aquinas, Natures are ordered towards ends, and the end of human nature is to be found in the knowledge and love of God. Butler's expressive individualism places human perfection in a different end, the exercise of freedom in the choice of an identity even and above any sense of nature. But does the choice of an identity perfect or distract from our freedom? Aquinas argues that we do have a certain level of freedom in choosing who we want to become and how we want to live out our humanity in a given setting at a given time, but that we don't have the freedom to choose what we fundamentally are or where our happiness is ultimately to be found. For Aquinas, any choice to place something other than God at the center of our lives diminishes our freedom, because the use of our freedom for things contrary to our nature always results in the concrete lessening of our freedom as we become attached to the objects of our choices. In this way, freedom itself, if we exalt it over the knowledge and love of God, can sow the seeds of its own destruction. We can become addicted to ever-increasing exercises of freedom in the search for authenticity, and as a result, act in ways that are increasingly harmful to our nature, body, and soul. Lastly, a third question concerns our relationships with one another. In the Summa Contra Gentiles, Aquinas asks how it is that we should talk with one another about difficult but important subjects that we disagree about, something that as a culture we're not particularly good at these days. His answer is that any productive discussion has to take place on the basis of some common and shared assumptions. So the examples he gives: Catholics share the teaching of the Catholic Church. Catholic and non-Catholic Christians share the New Testament. Christians and members of the Jewish people share the Old Testament. But what about people outside the Judeo-Christian tradition? Aquinas says that with people outside our religious tradition, we can always carry on a discussion on the basis of our shared humanity. That is to say, on the basis of our shared nature. That nature, which we've all received equally from God, gives us a set of common experiences and common principles from which we can speak reasonably with any other human person about the basic facets of human life, even if we have to sometimes do a fair bit of translating on the particulars. But what if our nature is subject to change, or rather, to choice? If our choices can determine not only in a sense who, but also what we are, we lose our capacity for common discourse each time two people select two different identities. And the proliferation of identities according to the proliferation of possibilities means that our common discourse becomes exponentially fragmented, as indeed it has become. In many ways, I think that's what we're experiencing today with the echo chambers and increasingly aggressive rhetoric on both sides of the political spectrum. My hope is that if we return to Aquinas' understanding of nature as given by God and ordered to a common end, we can begin to repair the damage and take up our common calling to ultimate happiness, shared happiness, in the perfection of our human nature once more. Thank you very much.
Thanks for listening to this lecture on the Thomistic Institute podcast. The generosity of people like you makes this podcast possible. If you enjoy these talks, please consider showing your support at www.thomisticinstitute.org/donate. Your donation of even a dollar helps us reach more college students and many others with the powerful truths of the faith, and it ensures that we can keep publishing top-notch lectures on this podcast. Thanks a lot.